Welcome to the premiere issue of Notes from the Western Edge, a monthly on-demand audio webcast featuring musicians who create on the edges of jazz, new music, electronics, and a broad expanse of sonic spaces in between. In program number one, you'll hear from two ferocious lions of new jazz, drummer David King and guitarist Nels Klein. I spoke with David King at the Roosevelt Hotel on Hollywood Boulevard, just up the street from the Knitting Factory, where he and his Bad Plus cohorts were performing later that night. I spoke with Nels Klein on a lovely Saturday afternoon, sitting at his kitchen table right next to the refrigerator in his Eagle Rock home. The music you'll hear in this issue covers an extraordinarily wide range of styles and textures. Be prepared for assault, caress, and visions from another world. I hope you'll like what you hear and will join us as a subscriber. Just click on the subscribe button for more information.
I've always wanted to be this kind of bastard child of John Bonham and Elvin Jones. I genuinely enjoy all kinds of music, and it's not, I don't really have a preference. I really feel like good music is good music.
His soul infused with both the thunderous power of Led Zeppelin's John Bonham and the explosive African timelines of Elvin Jones with John Coltrane and others, David King burst into the limelight of the international jazz scene with the emergence of the Bad Plus in 2001 and 2. It might have seemed then as if he had come out of nowhere, but in reality, he had spent years developing his approach to the drums through his immersion in many styles of jazz and rock.
There's a period of searching that I think is important for any musician, but I mean, for me, most certainly, to balance the different genres, be able to be myself in all of them, which was really important, not just to play the genre. And that's been a huge learning experience and a long development.
Starting with high school jazz band classes in Minneapolis, his hometown as well as mine, King had moved to Los Angeles and lived there for 5 years doing session work and playing with numerous jazz and rock bands. Just as he was poised for major success as a touring drummer, he did some soul-searching and decided to move back home to reconnect with the essence of his musical creativity.
When I moved back to Minneapolis is when I really, in fact, the early years in Minneapolis, you probably remember, I was playing very, very out. Like, I was really searching for
free.
Some stuff. Very free. And very, and from someone who came from playing a lot of strict form and a lot of whatever, I was very interested in the idea of the drum becoming this full frontal melodic instrument right on the front line. I still am, you know, of course, that's all in there. It's all the tools. But at this point in time, I was really sharpening that tool. And I fell in with some people that really understood that, but I also definitely freaked some people out, where it's just like, geez, what is this? You know, I was playing with very extreme dynamic ranges, very busy, very dialogue-oriented, less support, more... And it was a period of searching for me. It was a few years, like 96 to 98, 96, 98, 99. I was really working it. I mean, anything I could think of in the moment, I was just going to go for it. It was very Cecil Taylor almost. It was just like, I just felt like that's the purest way for me to stretch out and then kind of rein it in a little bit to figure out what works and what doesn't. Luckily, I found some people that were willing to be a part of that ride, you know, some musicians in Minneapolis, who are the guys at Happy Apple, for instance.
I was living in the Twin Cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul and hosting Fresh Ears on KFAI-FM when Happy Apple began changing the face of the local jazz scene. The first time I heard King play was in a basement club downtown. At the time, the band included two saxophones, acoustic bass, and drums. They were playing a freewheeling style of jazz that owed much to the acoustic Ornette Coleman bands of the late 1950s and early 60s. Over the next few months, their sound took a radical turn into uncharted territory. Now a trio with Michael Lewis on saxophone, Eric Fratsky on electric bass, and King on drums, the band gave birth to not only their own unique sound, but also to a brand new audience for jazz, one I like to call the stocking cap crowd. Happy Apple self-produced their own concerts and gigs all over town, most notably at the Bryant Lake Bowl, an old-school bowling alley that also happened to contain a cozy 88-seat theater right next to the lanes. As the Apple's audience outgrew that space, they moved their concerts into the much larger Cedar Cultural Center, known mostly for hosting folk and roots musicians from all over the world. Once in a while, they'd also play traditional jazz clubs like St. Paul's Artists Quarter, a club that usually presents straight-ahead jazz to a straight-ahead crowd. The night I heard Happy Apple there, the club was packed with enthusiastic fans, but almost none of them were Artist Quarter regulars. Instead, they were mostly under the age of 30, many wearing stocking caps and loose-fitting clothes. Not your usual Artist Quarter crowd of wine-sipping sophisticates. This was a young, rowdy rock audience, turned on by both the sounds and the attitudes of the young musicians in Happy Apple. Besides myself, I saw only one other audience member over the age of 30 or so. Not only was King's emergence as a musician a long-term project, the next band he co-founded, The Bad Plus, grew out of a friendship between King and bassist Reed Anderson that stretched back to junior high. Pianist Ethan Iverson came into the picture slightly later.
We all grew up together. I knew those guys when we were all teenagers. I met Reed when we were 14. We were in junior high together. We started playing rock bands and jazz. We got really heavily into jazz in high school. That's when I really started to bury myself in Coltrane and things like that, and Reed was also. And we met Ethan right out of high school. Reed went to Eau Claire for 1 year, and I stayed in the Twin Cities that 1 year before I moved out west. And Reed was studying jazz at University of Wisconsin, Eau Claire, and he met this young pianist who was 15 at the time, who was playing with the college ensembles. He was still in high school, and that was Ethan. And they kind of hit it off. Ethan was beyond his years as usual, and he he still is. And they formed this kind of a partnership that they were playing a lot in Eau Claire. Reed came home that summer. Reed and I are still, we're best friends and playing all the time. And he came home that summer, and we were all going to be moving. Reed was going to be moving out east to go to the Curtis Institute in Philadelphia, and I was going to move to California. So we had this session before we left at Reed's parents' house, and he brought this young pianist with him. He was 15 or 16 at the time. It was Ethan. And we played a session in the living room. And we knew right away that the three of us were very kind of hell-bent on doing our own thing. We were searchers right away. No one was being the polite jam session musician. Everyone was like, no, let's do this or this. Everyone had a kind of a type A personality. And it was fun. And we all went our separate ways. Ethan finished high school and then moved out to New York, hooked up with Reed out there, and I was out here. And we always kept in contact. And we were big fans of each other's work. And I brought Reed out to L.A. to do this record that I was talking about. And he came out and did a record with me and a local jazz guitarist named Dave Askren, a brilliant player out here. And Ethan, came through the Midwest doing a piano tour and used me as his drummer, that kind of thing. We were always in each other's radar. And they started to become fans of Happy Apple. And that's really how the Bad Plus began, is they started to see how Happy Apple was this real group identity. This sound was emerging. And of course, in the history of jazz, the most potent jazz music has been made, I think, by working bands. not just leaders with anyone who's there, but actual dialogues, long-time relationships. I think no one can really argue that. The great music.
Absolutely.
Of all those leaders was based on their relationships with the people in the band. And I think they were growing a little tired of piecemeal bands in New York, trying to keep projects together, needing to pay your rent, so everyone needs to take whatever gig they can. That kind of thing that New York had become. It's rare that there are these leaders bringing up people anymore, or if they are, they want a very specific thing and not a wide open thing. And they started thinking, well, this might be the way to go. And they asked me if I would be interested in playing with them. And of course I said absolutely, and I brought them to Minneapolis and we played a weekend at a club called the Artist Quarter just to see how it would go. We rehearsed for an hour or so. We immediately had that same energy, but at this point, 10 years later, we had really formulated our own things at this point and matured as players, of course.
When the Bad Plus burst onto the international jazz scene like a rocket ship blasting off of the moon, the jazz world was split into two opposing camps almost immediately. One camp applauded with great enthusiasm, while the other camp booed and hissed with all their might. The most common complaint heard from the hissing side was, they don't swing, as if jazz must adhere to a dotted 8/16th note rhythm in 4/4 time to be jazz. The booers and the hissers were ignoring the fact that since the days of ragtime over 100 years ago, creative jazz musicians have always taken popular music of the day and shaped it in their own image. The Bad Plus is doing exactly that, with popular music from our time, as in their take on Nirvana's Smells Like Teen Spirit.
When we were asked all the time why people respond to our thing differently than they've responded to, because jazz musicians have played pop music forever, and recently tons of them play rock music. We always go back to, it must be that there is never a concrete concept that it has to be this one thing. It just has to be ours. We have to play it like we approach music. So everything gets in there, the rock backgrounds, the classical backgrounds, the jazz backgrounds, it all comes through. And it's done with real earnest feeling. It's not done as this other thing. It's really like, this is important a piece of music to us as our own music.
Remember King talking about all the rock bands he's been in since junior high? Well, along with being a member of two of the most significant jazz bands of our time, he's a member of the Twin Cities-based Halloween Alaska, a quartet with a dreamy sound all their own. King's drumming here is nothing like what he plays in his jazz groups. Here he is fairly subdued, almost submerged into the sound. Precisely perfect for the music that surrounds him. Being true to his roots is the essence of King's approach. I asked him what advice he could offer to young musicians as they find their own way in music.
Do your best to make sure that you are a part of the equation, that your voice is coming through. There's much to be played in improvised music or any music. All the great ideas have not been taken, and that's important to know. I think in jazz education, especially, there's this idea that you live underneath the blanket of the masters. And of course, the great music that has been played needs to be honored. But it's also important to know that all of those people felt free to explore beyond their influences. And I'm not sure that same type of availability is here today. The idea that you can be the next Thelonious Monk. You can be the next John Coltrane. You absolutely can. Those are human beings, and all human beings are infinitely creative. I really believe that. It's just about actually knowing it, believing that you can contribute on that level. No matter who doesn't think you can, no matter what power structure is in place, what academic structure, whatever, there is room. And so to remember that and to just not stop doing it, be the wrong person for the situation sometimes, because it pays off.
From Los Angeles for Fresh Ears Media, I'm Richard Paske. When you hear the lovely Spanish tinge of Nels Klein's acoustic guitar, accompanied here by Mark Dresser's acoustic bass, you might be fooled into thinking that you've got Nels Klein pegged, although the song's title, New Old Hat, might warn you that something else might be up. The very next track, Spider Wisdom, proves that this is so. Nels Klein is a Los Angeles-born and bred guitarist, most recently known for his work since 2004 with the Grammy Award-winning rock band Wilco. But for years before that, before his emergence into the realm of popular music, Klein had developed an underground reputation as one of the most innovative guitarists around. There's almost no genre he hasn't touched. He's played with the venerated jazz bassist Charlie Hayden, the enigmatic trumpeter Wadada Leo Smith, Thurston Moore of Sonic Youth, and one of the grand outlaws of country music, Willie Nelson. Add to that his work with vocalist Carla Bozulich and reed player Vinny Golia, along with most of the LA experimental jazz scene, and you've got one very busy, very in-demand guitar player. I asked Klein how this all happened.
I'd have to say it truly evolved on its own. I would have to qualify as probably one of the least careerist people playing music. I really never had enough self-confidence to go try to get gigs. I never hustled gigs. I never really called anybody. And I don't know how I ended up in my 20s playing with people like Julius Hemphill and Charlie Hayden. I mean, these were people I looked up to when I was growing up and listening to music. Similarly, later, playing with Mike Watt from the Minutemen, you know, who were a huge favorite of mine and really inspirational. A lot of times it was word of mouth. Somebody said, oh, you should meet this guy and play with him. Or, you know, in the case of somebody like Thurston Moore from Sonic Youth, who I very much enjoy playing with and I do sporadically and have done recordings with, I had met him working at the record store. I worked at Rhino Records in Westwood for years and would meet a lot of musicians there. Although I wasn't particularly gregarious, I think that when I wanted to talk to somebody, I guess I'd kind of bend their ear.
The first time I heard Klein's A Knot in the Wrist, I was flying west to east out of the sprawling LA basin, over the gentle roll of the San Gabriel Mountains, past the aqueous source of Lake Mead, through multiple instances of long, linear bands of sandy sediment, lining the rosy peaks of craggy diagonal buttes as far as my eyes could see. Further yet, in space and in time, brilliant, pristinely white snow peaks of great majesty loomed above the horizon. In the foreground, dark riverbeds winding, etched deep into scorched copper-hued flat iron plates, all of it remnants of geologic time. Into this impossible scene, Nels Klein thrust his music of seismic proportions. On their album Buried on Bunker Hill, Klein and electric bassist Devin Sarno take guitars and basses far away from conventional melody, harmony, and rhythm, deep into the realm of pure electronic soundscape. I asked Klein about his preferences in electronic music.
It's funny, I don't consider myself to be particularly well-versed in electronic music, although there was so much of it happening in the 60s and 70s, so I'm still probably more influenced by what is considered kind of outre electronic music at this point. I'm really influenced by the soundtrack to the movie Attack of the Mushroom People. I mean, I think that the echo sounds and the creepiness of that have lasted with me for a long time. And I think more so than listening to some kind of Xenakis piece or something. Certainly Edgar Varèse was very important, particularly coming at it backwards, like many other things, starting with rock, because my brother and I became aware of Varèse through Frank Zappa, who ripped him off mercilessly, but also always claimed to be inspired by him and quoted him on almost every early record. So Varèse became really important, particularly, I think that there's something really compelling about, it's startling about the way he uses the sounds. And musique concrète, I think, is maybe more interesting to me sometimes than early wall-sized Moog music or something. But even that, even something as goofy as Dick Hyman, I think it was, who did the Minotaur. I mean, that was a huge song when I was 13. So these things have an impact ultimately. And so I think that what I'm drawn to in terms of electronic sound isn't really particularly well thought out, but that I'm highly entertained by certain sounds that remind me of things like Attack of the Mushroom People. I also have to say that Chick Corea with Miles Davis playing Fender Rhodes with Echoplex and Ring Modulator was really huge. And still that period of Miles music with John McLaughlin and Jack DeJohnette and those people, I still am pretty damaged by that.
Damaged? Doesn't sound hurt to me, but certainly mad as a hornet. From Banyan's 2004 album Live at Perkins Place, which leads us to The Giant Pin, Klein's most recent recording with his trio, the Nels Klein Singers. Produced by violinist and composer Jeff Gauthier on his Cryptogrammophone record label, The Giant Pin features Devin Hoff on contrabass, Scott Amendola on percussion and live electronics, and of course, Klein on electric guitars and effects. Stylistically, The Giant Pin crosses many musical borders. For Klein, many of these borders were once nearly insurmountable. Now they're almost transparent.
The beauty of having my own group, which I didn't actually lead my own group for many years coming up, it was for so many reasons, but the beauty of it is that truly I just do anything I feel like doing, and I don't really care if it makes any sense. And I used to agonize over these dichotomies, the dilemma between acoustic and electric and rhythmic harmonic versus free atonal and all that kind of stuff. I had it all pretty much compartmentalized and in opposition to each other, you know? And I had to throw that away in order to actually not go nuts. I was having almost mental problems behind it, and I almost quit playing. So I just, when I started my original trio back in maybe 89, wasn't that long ago, I just dispensed with these concerns and just did anything I thought would be something I'd want to play and something crucially that I'd even want to listen to. And I don't mean my own soloing, but I mean compositionally, you know, or conceptually.
as evidenced in The Ballad of Devin Hoff, written as a solo vehicle for his bassist. Klein the composer and Klein the group leader is always thinking about how to allow his collaborators to shine. His groups are groups of equals, not collections of accompanists to play behind his solos. When I asked him about future projects, the ideas flowed freely, on and on and on.
Oh, well, I have way too many ideas for what to do this year, but I know that ultimately I'm touring a lot with Wilco and going to start doing some recording with them. But I have basically three singers-related projects I'd like to record, and I don't know which one I'm going to get to record, but... One is just a normal singer's record with a couple of guests. The other one is a singer's record with five percussionists added and possibly cello. Although I may have to combine all these things onto one CD. I don't know if it's going to be listenable that way. But ultimately, I'd also like to make a record with the singers backing Calvin Newborn, the great jazz guitar player, unsung jazz player. He's now living in Florida. He's 71 years old. He's basically a Memphis guy, but who's lived all over the country in his lifetime, and it's just a marvel. It'll be more of a straight-ahead jazz record, really, and play some of his songs and maybe my song that I dedicated to him and some standards. I want to record five duets with five different turntablists sometime as soon as I can find them all and get into studios or play live with them. Would be Christian Marclay and DJ Olive, Tom Rashawn, Otomi Oshihide, and Chang, DJ Chang from Group Dialect. I still want to finish a Scarnella record with Carla. Don't know how we're going to squeeze that one in. I'm going to record with the Gotet this year, Jeff Gautier's group as a guest. The new Scott Amendola Band record's already done.
And on and on and on. With these kind of plans, the years 2005 and beyond promise to bring an abundance of musical surprises from the wellspring of creativity that is Nels Klein. Reporting from Los Angeles for Fresh Ears Media, I'm Richard Paskey. Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the show. Next time, we'll hear music from one of the legends of modern jazz, Joe Zawinul, and from an artist who blurs the boundaries between music, video, and social activism with his arsenal of laptop computers, DJ Spooky. In Los Angeles for Fresh Ears Media, I'm Richard Paskey. Until next time, keep listening.